This is a collection of recordings I made with some of the world's most knowledgeable, well-known, and successful whitetail hunters on the planet. I know you're really going to enjoy and learn from the wisdom they share, along with their personal life and their walk with God. I hope you enjoy these classic conversations. Boy, I've got a real treat for you today. I have with me on the phone Charles Alsheimer, and I'm sure many of you know his works, you know his pictures, you know him as probably the predominant deer hunting voice of this last, several decades at least. And Charlie, it is really an honor to have you with us today.
Brian, it's great to be with you, and I'm looking forward to our call.
You know, I was reading your bio. It's really amazing to see the history you have. Now, you grew up in a farm in rural upstate New York. Where was that?
It's the western part of the state. It's what they call the Finger Lakes region, actually Steuben County. The county borders Pennsylvania. Pretty rural, pretty rugged, pretty remote. At least it was until the last 15 or 20 years. And so I was in farm country. I was brought up on a 500-acre potato farm. My grandfather and father were potato farmers, and so that's kind of my roots. And interestingly, my wife and I bought a farm in 1973. It's not as big as the one I grew up on, but it borders the farm I grew up on, so I didn't go too far.
I see in 1979 it says you left a promising career in the corporate world. What were you doing?
After I got out of college, I took a job in sales and marketing for a very large wood office furniture business. It was a corporation. At the time, they were the largest producer of wood office furniture in the world, and I was involved in the sales department. And started to climb the corporate ladder. Was one of those guys that not only loved the outdoors, but I was my uniform of the day, if you will, was a coat and tie. So flew around the country representing this company, and was involved in a lot of the contracts that they were involved in, a lot of government work, and quite frankly, a lot of aspects of that job were pretty exciting, and I thought, I can do this forever. So that's really where I thought my career was going to be. And then in 1979, a lot of things changed, and as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, it says on here your first national magazine cover didn't come until nearly a decade after becoming a full-time outdoor communicator. What was that on?
It was a cover that appeared on Deer and Deer Hunting magazine. That in 1979, there were not many national hunting publications. Matter of fact, you had Outdoor Life, Field and Stream, Sports Afield, American Hunter, and then Deer and Deer Hunting burst onto the scene in the 1980s, and that was actually my first cover, and then, everything kind of snowballed after that, and I was blessed to be able to travel the country, do an awful lot of whitetail photography, and I guess my background as a hunter allowed me to do what I do today, because I was pretty passionate about hunting when I was a kid growing up.
You know, I grew up in northwestern Pennsylvania, and I think everyone is a deer hunter there. I mean, it's just kind of, you're raised with that. So I understand the whole Northeast is really whitetail crazy, and I was blessed to be able to grow up in that. You know, it says in 1996 that the Nikon Hunting Annual called you the hottest outdoor photographer in the field. And today, everyone, I think, recognizes you, within the media or on television or whatever, as being one of the leading authorities on whitetail deer. I found it really funny. I was reading this, and I got to the bottom of the page, and it said in January 2000 that Deer and Deer Hunting sponsored a national survey in which participants were asked to select deer hunting's top inspirational leaders of the 20th century from a list of 57 scientists, manufacturers, politicians, celebrities, communicators, and well-known hunters. And this is pretty neat. You were selected third in the voting, just behind bow hunting legend Fred Bear, and which I thought was really neat was the person who came after you was President Theodore Roosevelt. That's got to be a pretty neat award.
Well, first of all, Brent, that's kind of pretty humbling stuff. I can remember when the magazine called me on the phone to tell me the results. I kind of scratched my head and I says, well, hey, the guys in front of me and behind me are dead. What's that say for me? But the bottom line to that had to be the fact that understand that that survey was done in 2000. There was a lot of surveys like it. Who's the best major league player? Who's the best professional football player? That just seemed to be the thing to do. And it's kind of one of those things. Whoever's got the hot iron at the time seems to get the votes or whatever. And so it's pretty humbling. I mean, there's no way that I'm in any kind of class with a Fred Bear or an Aldo Leopold or even Teddy Roosevelt for that matter. But again, it's pretty flattering, and and again, at the same time, humbling. But so anyway, it was enjoyable. It was enjoyable to hear it and see all that stuff. But I understand the reality of that.
Well, and I understand from speaking with you, you are very humble. You're very, again, the word is humble about, you know, your all your accomplishments or awards. You've written tons of books. You know, Strategies for Whitetails, Whitetail Rights of Autumn, Quality Deer Management. I know you from the QDMA stuff quite a bit. A lot of my friends are involved with that. You're always speaking, I know, all around the country, not only for QDMA, you know, meetings, but in civic centers and in churches and schools. It's just, again, it's a real honor to have you here, and I think the guys are probably really waiting to hear what you've got to say to us. So let's go ahead and get started with that. These events that you go out and you speak at, I know you have, you might have 100 guys, you might have 1,000 guys, but I know in that audience you're always going to have, you know, the novice hunter. It could be a kid, you know, it could be an adult whose father didn't maybe hunt and he wants to get into it now. But you, a lot of these young kids really wanting to get out there, what can you pass on to them that's really going to help make them successful?
I think, you know, when I think about that, the number one thing that I tell, whether it's a novice or somebody that's really been at it a while and really trying to go to the next level, if you will, is that the whole key to this whole whitetail game is understanding deer behavior. Now, that may seem a little bit simplistic to say that, but I can't emphasize it enough. If you know deer behavior, you're going to be a good hunter, and that's critical. And I'm not talking about just understanding deer behavior in the month you happen to be hunting in. I'm talking about know why they do what they do all 12 months. Now, I can tell you that as a kid growing up, I was passionate about whitetails. We had a farm that was loaded with them, so I saw them all the time, but they were not the same each month. They changed. They gravitated to certain food sources. Their attitude, their behavior changed. I mean, the rutting behavior fascinated me. And so I had to kind of learn as I went. Now, today, a young hunter can go and he can get a tape on deer behavior, and he can know what scraping and rubbing behavior is all about. He can know all the fine aspects of lip curling, why they do that, when that rut might unfold. There's a lot of things, but they've got to be able to understand deer behavior, and that's critical. The books that are out there, the media that's there today, helps them flatten out that learning curve. So the number one thing is know deer behavior, because he who knows behavior is going to be a good hunter. That's the basics. That's where you begin. It's kind of like a golfer. You know, I mean, unless you've got the right grip, you're not going to be a decent golfer. And so it's kind of like the way it is with whitetails. You need to know the deer.
Well, I know you get a lot of guys coming to the events who have been hunting for a lot of years. I know I learn things from guys who have been in the field, you know, that come to the events even when I get a chance to, you know, listen to them. And the experienced hunter, the guys that are coming that really know what they're doing, what are some tips or secrets or things that you can pass on to them who've been doing this for a long time that can even make them more successful?
Well, Brent, once you get to where you really understand your behavior, I think two things that will really take that hunter's ability to the next level is, number one, being able to master the wind. And I'm talking about all the wind currents that can occur around your tree stand, because it's going to change. It's going to change by season. It's going to change by the time of the day. And it's going to change depending on what the wind velocity is. And so how can you do this? How can you understand what it's all about where you happen to be hunting? Well, one of the basic things that I tell folks that attend one of the summer schools that I teach on deer hunting is go to a dollar store and buy that cheap bubble material that these kids, they'll kind of blow on it and you'll have bubbles floating through the air. Well, just get that little bottle and that little wand that they have in the bottle and just kind of take it into your stand and blow those bubbles and see where they float. I think you'll be amazed, because once you know this, you're going to be able to say, okay, I need to move the stand. I can't have it right here if I want to be really good at what I do, because that's going to be the key. In our research, we know that a white-tailed deer can detect an estrus doe at 420 paces.
Wow.
Now, whether it's 500, we don't know that, but we do know 420. So that's number one. Number two, and this is critical, you need to understand that you have to be a stealth hunter on your entry and exit from the stand. so critical. You cannot go near where you expect those deer are going to be moving through, because you can't leave any odor there. I've already told you about how far they can smell. And believe me, in all these years that I've been raising whitetails, the thing that amazes me more than anything else about them is their ability to smell. Even the best scent eliminating suits will not beat a whitetail's nose 100% of the time. Can't be done. And so as a result, those are two things. Master the wind around your stand and have an incredible entry exit to the stand. Now, how can you make that entry and exit better? Well, I take the extra step and I actually rake the last 100 yards to the stand. So when I'm walking in, it's kind of like me with socks on concrete. As quiet as you possibly can be. And those are two things that I believe will take a hunter to the next level.
Have you ever heard of guys walking in the afternoon hunt with a turkey call in their mouth?
I've heard that. And matter of fact, you're talking to a guy that does it. oftentimes, right. So we're in turkey country. I carry a diaphragm call with me whenever I hunt whitetails. In fact, you'd be amazed at the number of times you might bump a deer, and that animal may or may not be sure of what exactly has happened. I'll just give some soft yelps, and often it will calm that deer back down. And so, yeah, that's standard equipment with me, as well as rattling antlers and a grunt tube, is a diaphragm call. Use it often, and sometimes use a lot, yeah.
I love hearing little things like that, because it makes sense when you think about the other animals in the woods, what they're used to hearing, how they communicate. You know, again, growing up in turkey country as well, many times when I'm seeing deer, I'm seeing turkey, and I've watched turkey, you know, stand there and watch a deer who made something and just really study his movement and vice versa. I mean, they go back and forth, and I think that's a great little secret, little tip.
One more thing with that, to add to that turkey call, and that is, let's assume you're on stand and you've got a deer within, say, 30 yards of you, and perhaps you make a movement that they're not quite sure what it's all about, and it might startle them a little bit. I'll give a couple of yelps and do it real soft, not real loud, and that'll often calm that deer back down. So it's a lot of ways to use a turkey call, especially if you're in an area that has a lot of turkeys.
I think every guy out there probably listening to this has gotten busted in a tree stand. Maybe they were at full draw and had to let down, or they made some little metallic sound with their arrow ticking the side of their bow, where that little trick could save them a trophy. But that's a great tip. What about the last 10 years? I mean, you have been hunting for how many years now?
Well, I'm 63 years old. I started hunting whitetails in 1966. So if you do the numbers, I lost 4 years in the Air Force. So I've been at it a long time. But understand that I grew up in farm country, and farm country meant that the kids did the driving of the woods for the fathers. And so I've been going to a deer woods since I'm 5 years old. So this coming fall, you know, it's going to be my 54th year in a deer woods.
Wow. Well, you've got a lot of knowledge. And this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because there's a lot of information we're always reading in all these different bow hunting, whether it's deer and deer hunting or Peterson's bow hunting or whatever. But to hear someone like yourself, what's the biggest lesson you think maybe in the last 10 years that you've learned that maybe you didn't know before that has really changed the way you hunt, your success, your enjoyment, any of those things?
Well, that's got to be, again, having to do with behavior, but specifically, understand that, I'm a deer hunter. A lot of folks know me as a deer hunter. I grew up that way. I was passionate about it. I trapped and did a lot of hunting growing up. But when I was 24 years old, I began to carry a camera, did a lot of photography, did it all over North America, have kind of dedicated my life to being able to share my photos with a lot of people. And over that period of time, I always knew that in the north, the whitetail rut was going to fall in the month of November. And we're talking about north of, say, the 35th latitude, which is basically Charlotte, North Carolina. But we knew it was going to be in November. But as myself and other serious deer photographers were spending literally every single day from September through December in the woods photographing, we started to scratch our heads and we started to think, you know, there's something funny going on here, because there are some years that peak breeding is occurring early in November. Other years it's happening mid-November. And there's a few years where it happens to be happening around Thanksgiving week. Why is that? Well, the biologists know that shortening day length plays the critical role in determining when the rut's going to occur. But roughly 16 years ago, myself and a wildlife biologist by the name of Wayne LaRoche, Wayne happens to be the Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife for the state of Vermont, we launched a research project dealing with how both shortening day length and the second full moon after the autumn equinox, the role that those two play in determining when the whitetail rut will occur in the north. And we're not done with this yet. This is an ongoing deal. We wanted it to run 15 years because of the way the full moon cycles, because it's not the same from year to year. It's roughly the same every 3 years. And so we knew for science to be good science, number one, it has to be repeatable, and number two, it needs to be observable. So we started collecting data. We used computers, light meters, motion sensing cameras, a lot of stuff. And over that last 10 years, we've been able to see clearly that when the second full moon after the autumn equinox occurs, buck behavior really picks up. And then roughly 7 days after that full moon, as we are cycling into a total dark night under the new moon, peak breeding occurs. It's been fascinating. And interestingly enough, in the last week, I have been getting calls from outfitters in Canada that want to tell me that they see the same kind of cycling going on with both moose and elk. And so there's more to it than just the month of November. So because of that, I'm able to share with folks, you know, when's going to be the peak time each year. And it's been pretty fascinating. It's not rocket science. It's not perfect, but it gives you a heads up on knowing what are the prime times you need to be there. And so it's been pretty fascinating. And quite frankly, it's amazing the hundreds and hundreds of deer hunters that have contacted both myself and Wayne in the 12 years we've been doing this research. It's very interesting to see the correlation between how the days get shorter and then the moon phase kicks in November, specifically that full moon in November. When that happens, that buck activity really ramps up. And then you kind of segue into the breeding phase of the rut about 7 days after the full moon.
Besides the photoperiodism and all those different things, is there any research about, for instance, like the acorn crop, whether it's a bumper year, whether it's a drought year, how much fat she has to have around her kidneys in order to kick that estrus in? Is there anything to that?
Well, obviously, the healthier whitetail does will be more consistent in how they're going to cycle. If you have healthy animals, things happen the way they should happen. If you do not have healthy animals, then a lot of very strange things can happen. And by the way, the same thing happens with humans. And so if an animal can go into the fall with a great food source and it's a mature animal, meaning it's over 2.5 or 3.5 years old, it's pretty predictable what's going to take place. But if an animal is stressed, where they don't have a good food source and they don't have good fat deposits, and quite frankly they're living on the margins, and things get tough for them.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, we know so much information that we have read through magazines and television that has come from your research or those who you work with, and we thank you for your wisdom. But there's something that I'd like to ask you, because those of us who know you from seeing you speaking in churches and different places know that there's another reason why you do what you do. And you as the person, not as the outdoor photographer and the specialist on whitetail, but when it comes to you personally, what you're passionate about, why do you do what you do?
Well, Brent, that goes back to my youth and the fact that I was a kid that grew up close to nature. I loved it. I knew from an early age that somebody had to have made it. And I say that to also say this: I was not from a church family. We were not regular church attenders by any means. So my mom and dad were not Christians as I was growing up. But I still knew there was a God. Common sense kind of told me that. And as I got into this whole nature thing, I got older. I wound up in a place called Vietnam. I took America for granted, like so many people do. Didn't realize how unique this country was, didn't realize the true blessings this country offered, and literally overnight found myself in a war zone. I was 14 months in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and there were some interesting times, as many of the GIs had there. Went through some pretty harrowing experiences. And out of that whole process, I came to appreciate America. But more than that, I came to appreciate the fact that there had to be a God out there. There had to be something more to life than what I was seeing. And when I got back home in 1970, got serious about a gal who family was Christian. She was Christian. And one way to get a date on a Sunday morning, I went where she went. She went to church. And that kind of launched things where I really started to figure out what life was all about. And accepted Jesus as my Savior on the 23rd of April, 1971. And I can tell you that that's the day my life truly began. I mean, it added meaning to it. Married the teacher, graduated from college, got involved in the church I was going to. The more I did it, the more I wanted to do it. God placed that camera in my hand. I started to photograph his creation. And kind of like, you know, I mean, kind of out of the blue, if you will, it's almost like you sense a calling. And the calling was to share God's creation with those around you. He gave me this platform. He gave me this ability. And I just felt that I needed to share it. And so one thing led to another. I started to speak. I started to share. And out of that whole process, it's been amazing to me to see how God has allowed me to work in men's lives and hunters' lives. And you go from place to place, and you speak, and you find people, you help, you kind of share with them what the real answer to life is. And the real answer to life is not what we see here. It's not things. As Chuck Swindoll has said often, the greatest things in life are not things. The greatest things in life are the experiences you have with your loved ones and the God that made you. And because of that, you know, it's been a long time ago that I accepted Christ as my Savior, and that's what drives me, to share his blessings and to share God's Son, Jesus Christ, with those that I come in contact with. But more importantly, to share with those individuals that, as Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father except through me. And that's kind of the message that I like to leave with folks, and that they can take your abilities, they can take your talents, they can take a broken person. Christ can do that, and he can use you in mighty ways. God's gift to us is life. Our gift to God is what we do with our life. Not how many deer we kill. Yeah. Not how many elk we put on the ground or anything like that. The answer is, what are we going to do with God? And so that's what I try to share with the audiences that I talk with.
I think a lot of guys out there, you know, we sit in our living room and we're armchair hunters, or even when we go out, we idolize these guys that we see out there on these television shows. But I think you would reiterate this. The truth is, there's no difference between us and Christ, none, because the same God of the universe, if I've received Christ, that is in you, is in me. And it doesn't make either one of us any better than the other, because it's God who we get our worth from, not how big deer we've shot or how what we've done with whatever our career is. I think men tend to get their identity from who, you know, what, when a man meets another man, they always say, what do you do? And what we do is no way connected with who we are. And that's what I hear you saying to these guys out there is, you know, we serve this big God in the universe, and it's not about all these great accomplishments you have, but it's that you have the God of the universe in you, and that's where your worth comes from.
No question about it, Brent. You know, God wants us to worship him. That's why we are here. And it's not here to kill big deer or anything like that. We're here to worship him. We're here to share him with those around us that may not know him. And so that's our mission, and that's what it ought to be, and that's where all the emphasis ought to be placed. And so, you know, I'm one of those guys that I continually get asked by people, when are you going to retire? I kind of look at them with a smile on my face, and I say to them, why would I want to retire? I mean, people retire to try to do what I'm doing, and God has allowed me to do this for 30 years. And so I'm going to continue doing it. I'm going to continue pressing on. I'm going to continue to be able to share Christ with every place I go, with all the audiences, and I can see how it changes lives. It changed me. And if he can change me, he can change everybody.
Well, I know you are reaching a lot of people with what you do, not only through your photographs and through your teaching, but with who you are, because you know who you are, and that who you are comes from Christ. Charlie, thank you. I want to thank you for being a soldier and defending our country. I have the highest respect for those in our armed forces who are out there laying their life on the line every single day, the things we never see that gives us the freedoms that we have here. I want to thank you for your Christian, your character, your being a mentor, your being a brother who is not afraid to share the ups and downs of your life that leads us you know, back to our relationship with God, the most important thing we have. And if there's any way that guys can get a hold of you that are looking maybe to contact you, want to bring you in for an event, how would they do that?
Brent, the best way for them to do that is by going to my website, which is www.charleselsheimer.com. And my last name is spelled A-L-S-H-E-I-M-E-R. If you go to the website, you can kind of click on the contact information, and you can get me that way and leave a phone number, and I'll get right back to you.
Do you have any new projects you're working on that we can be looking for coming up?
I do. I've got a brand new book that's due to be released on the 30th of September. It's called Whitetails, A Photographic Journey Through the Seasons. It's unlike any deer book that's ever been done. And basically chronicles six whitetail deer through the entire year, starting with the month of April and ending with March. Big mature whitetail buck, 6 years old. An 8-year-old mature whitetail doe, a yearling whitetail buck, and the doe's daughter from the year before and her two fawns. So those are the six characters in this whole thing, and it kind of shares their life through the whole year. There's over 230 photographs, all color. It's a hardcover coffee table book, and that's coming out. It's coming out shortly, and so pretty excited about it. I got my advance copy yesterday, and so I'm pumped.
That is neat stuff. I can't wait. I know a lot of guys out there are going to want to get this. Buddy, thank you so much for giving us your time, your wisdom. Boy, both from the outside of what we can see and on the inside of the things that we don't see, they're in us. And really appreciate your time, and keep hunting for truth, and hopefully we'll see you in the woods.
Great to be with you.